You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Let's keep on that Netflix theme, shall we? They report earnings next week, and that's usually a big event for the stock. Let's welcome Geetha Ranganathan. She is the technology and media analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. She's been covering this company pretty much since its inception as a public company. Geetha, thanks so much for joining us here. What can we expect? What are investors really looking for when Netflix reports next week?
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul and Taylor, for inviting me to this conversation. So it's going to be a pretty weak quarter for Netflix. They have telegraphed that pretty well to investors. So they're expecting about 1 million additions. This will be the lowest ever for the company in at least 10 years. And really, it's a factor of many different things. So you had that massive pull forward of demand from last year because of COVID, when they reported 26 million subscribers in the first half of 2020. That's usually the number that they report for the whole year. And then you also have now, the additional factor of people wanting to go more outdoors and demanding more out-of-home entertainment. And then the third thing that we're seeing is that there was obviously the effect of all those production shutdowns. So they had a pretty light content slate in 2Q, none of their big titles. So it's really the impact of all those three. And so a pretty weak quarter is what we're expecting in general.
With that weak quarter that we're expecting, it seems like Netflix is trying to get ahead of that announcement and help engagement and help penetration by going into video games. What can we expect from Netflix a la video games?
Yeah, I think that's, it's kind of been in the offing, I think, for a little while now. And I think it's really a very natural extension of their content strategy. I think what they're trying to do is to really be a comprehensive entertainment solution and really trying to build more and more engagement, as you pointed out, and really more time spent with the platform. Remember, a few years ago when, Reed Hastings was asked about who their biggest competitor is, he didn't say Amazon Prime or even HBO. He pointed out Fortnite as being their biggest competitor for time and attention. So that's really kind of what they want. They want to, increase engagement. They want to increase time spent. And I think it really kind of makes sense. It's a huge opportunity for Netflix to be able to differentiate its content offering, boost subscriber engagement, boost retention against all the other streaming players.
Geetha, talk to us about the competitive environment. Again, over the last year, we saw a lot of new players on the streaming business, Disney Plus and Peacock and, all the others that are out there. Give us a sense of how it's shaking out in these early quarters.
So, as you pointed out, Paul, Disney Plus has been a runaway hit. So they have amassed more than 100 million subscribers in, just a very short span of about 13 to 14 months. So it's been a blockbuster success for them. And of course, as you pointed out, we've had a lot of new players kind of burst onto the screen. But I think we're kind of seeing emerge as a two-horse race, if you will, between Netflix and Disney. But you're also seeing all the other players kind of trying to jockey for scale. So Amazon Prime did two very big deals just in the space of, the past few weeks. They went out and acquired the NFL Thursday night games for about $11 to $12 billion, and then the MGM studio for another $8.5 billion. So, again, they really want to make Prime a top-tier service. Then you have HBO Max and the Discovery deal, creating a new company, $150 billion company. Again, HBO Max wanting to kind of break into that top tier streaming offering. So we're definitely going to see a shakeout. I think at the end of the day, we're probably going to see about 3 or 4 or 5 major services, Netflix and Disney and Amazon, obviously the top 1, 2, 3, I think, among those. And then it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with, you know, NBC's Peacock, what happens with Viacom's Paramount Plus. I think eventually consolidation is on the cards, but we'll have to wait and watch.
There seems to be a push-pull. We feel like there has to be consolidation because you have to be big to compete. And yet we're getting a lot of big antitrust, anti-big tech rhetoric out of this administration saying that they don't like big companies. They want to promote competition. Do you expect deals to get done, and do they get done, or are they going to be tied up in courts for a while?
Yeah, so even with the, that's a great point. I think even with the Amazon deal, I mean, we have the new, you know, FTC chair who kind of expressed some reservations about that. But I don't think they're necessarily, if you kind of just look at the business that, you know, any of these big tech players are in, I don't think they necessarily pose any competitive challenges, right? Acquiring a studio, acquiring a media company. Again, I'm not really sure about how long it could be tied up in courts, but I think ultimately, you know, if tech players like an Apple or an Amazon wants to go out and acquire a studio, I think they should be able to do so without too much hassle.
Keitha, real quick, 30 seconds. Is Netflix still a subscriber growth story? I see the stock's flat year to date.
So they have done a really good job, Paul, in kind of moving away a little bit from that over-focus on subscribers. They're really now focusing more on free cash flows, on margins. And they're showing some really good numbers on that front as well.
All right, Keitha, thank you so much for joining us. As always, you are our guru for all things TMT. Keitha Ranganathan, technology and media analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us on the phone from New Jersey. I hired Keitha back in the day.
Aww.
We worked together for 10 years, and she has just developed into one of the top media and now technology analysts on Wall Street. And we're fortunate to have her and all the other good folks at Bloomberg Intelligence.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do, that's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Talk about retail sales. Got some numbers this morning. Came in better than expected. Retail sales came in at a 0.6% gain versus a forecast of a 0.3% decline. So pretty strong there. Let's get some details on that and some of the other retail issues out there in the U.S. consumer. We do that with Anji Solanki, National Director for Retail in the U.S. for Colliers International, joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Anji, thanks so much for taking the time. Love to get your kind of 30,000-foot snapshot on the U.S. consumer right here as we slowly come out on the other side of this pandemic.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So let's just dive in. So what we're seeing right now is definitely in 2020, we saw certain categories in retail, i.e. clothing, certain F&B categories, department store sales drop anywhere between 20 to 25%. And of course, conversely, we saw the e-commerce jump and rise. Now we're starting to see a shift. People are definitely coming back strong as it relates to buying power in store. And with that, we're starting to see in certain sectors a rebound. For example, in apparel, 47% increase. It's the largest increase we've seen thus far in any category. And also, in addition to that, we're starting to see store expansion. So this is led by the grocery, the home, beauty, and value-oriented concepts. So new store openings right now are outpacing store closings. We're pretty excited about that.
How are consumers feeling about paying higher prices? On one hand, you have retail sales that looked relatively strong today, but then you're seeing consumer sentiment fall because inflation expectations in the next year are expected to be the highest since 2008. Are they willing to pay these higher prices?
So there is definitely a concern around that, I think, because there's this, kind of the stimulus payment is starting to slowly fade away. So they haven't really put 100% of their mindset into, hey, we're looking at inflation of some sort in pricing. So there's still a strong spend. And what we're seeing some of that strong spend occur is in what I would say more the service-oriented side. So going to the massage, getting a massage, going for a pedicure, manicure, getting your hair done, in the hair salons, et cetera. So we're still seeing that momentum. I think it will start to fade. Maybe we'll probably see those results closer to Q3, Q4.
So, Angie, one of the things we saw from this, from the retail perspective during this pandemic, is what a lot of folks are saying is just, you know, this accelerating growth of e-commerce, and maybe it might have pulled maybe 2 or 3 years worth of market share gains in terms of e-commerce, in terms of relative to total retail sales, maybe pulled it forward maybe by 2 or 3 years. Is that in fact the case? And do you think some of those e-commerce gains are here to stay?
I do not believe they are here to stay. I think they are a part of our shopping journey for any consumer. However, what we're starting to see is a bit of a cutback as it relates to e-commerce, and our Q2 numbers that we're forecasting are roughly around 13.6% compared to Q2 of 2020. So granted, it was kind of an off quarter, but nonetheless, we're starting to see a stabilization. And I think that people are still, there's still, you know, when we look at the square footage in terms of per person square footage of retail, it's still pretty significant. People want to be out there.
Are we finding enough workers to come back to work?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, it's been a big struggle. Some quick things that we've been hearing, especially with chain restaurants and fast casual, what we're seeing in that, you know, in that area is that it has been a struggle. So what are they doing? Well, they've identified some interesting ways to get around it. First off, we're seeing a lot of the chain restaurants being quite creative with how they're approaching or how they're getting out there to identify new employees. So we're not seeing too much of an overpaying or a rise in wages, but we're seeing some interesting things of how they're kind of connecting with, you know, this, you know, the employees. And that's either through TikTok. So a lot of the brands are starting to use TikTok to really get the brand awareness out there, to use that as a way of putting out, getting resumes in and out, and trying to tap into kind of that younger set. So that's one. The other thing that I found very interesting is that they're actually offering signing bonuses. Some brands are offering signing bonuses to get people in. So it's we'll start to see some shifts there, but for the most part, specifically when it comes to labor and restaurants, they are still challenged. We're seeing that with kind of reduced menu offerings, reduced operating hours, et cetera. And so they have to be creative today.
I think some of the retailers were pretty creative during this pandemic. One of them, it was this curbside pickup. That was a pretty cool thing. I kind of enjoy that. Is that going to stay, do you think?
Oh, most definitely. We're actually starting to see, letters of intent requesting or requiring curbside pickup. So when I was speaking with a variety of national retailers, I said, how is that, you know, helped or not helped having curbside? Is it an added expense? They said, not at all. It's actually a convenience to our customer, and it's another channel of how we can provide another solution for that customer, where if they don't feel like they want to come into the store and they just want to pick it up curbside, they have that flexibility. And so that's really important to them. They've seen a lift in sales anywhere between 12 to 15% by having curbside.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, seeing retailers get pretty creative. Anjay Solanki, National Director Retail for in the U.S. for Colliers International, giving us her thoughts on the retail landscape. Again, generally pretty strong as consumer confidence continues to rebound. All right, so we are getting right into the meat of this earnings season. And there's a lot of folks out there that say, boy, these earnings really better come through. Because when you look at valuations, you can make the argument that a lot of these parts of the market are overextended from a valuation perspective. Josh Wine, portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds, joins us. Josh, love to get your thoughts on kind of what you need to see, what you expect to see out of this earnings season here as it relates to, you know, kind of maybe earnings and valuations in this market.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. I have a smile on my face hearing about karaoke and Dolly Parton. That's a great way to start this out. The world's a better place for my not doing karaoke as well. Earnings season, certainly want to see the consumer. So as companies roll out earnings, you know, it was very interesting to see bank earnings, and I think it was expected, you know, very strong earnings there. But, you know, we have a retail sales number today that was well ahead of expectations, and things like clothing and electronics and restaurants were, you know, above average growth and ahead of expectations. So, you know, it is what it is, and it would be great to hear, you know, some guidance, you know, what are, you know, companies thinking about, you know, the next quarter. You know, right now we have very easy comparisons to a year ago, but, you know, let's see, you know, what it's going to look like in Q4 when the comparison is meaningfully more difficult, and certainly Q1 of next year, it'll be somewhat of a regular comparison to Q1 of this year.
Josh, how are you investing in this time when you get strong retail sales, but then you see consumer sentiment coming really soft given 1 year inflation expectations are going back the highest since 2008? How do you take two contradicting factors and invest?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I was looking, you know, the market, you know, 20 times forward earnings, so about a 5% earnings yield against a backdrop of a 1.3 on the 10-year. So, you know, valuations on average are incredibly compelling. You know, they're basically that spread, the earnings yield versus the 10-year is where we were before the pandemic started. That being said, you know, yeah, certainly size matters a lot in this market, increasingly so. So, you know, a Microsoft, great company, you know, 34 times forward earnings. When I see that, and they're growing quite nicely, but I think to myself that the market definitely places a premium on growth. I think more so in the case of a Microsoft, it's not only a great balance sheet, but just the size and the liquidity. So I think that there is definitely a size and liquidity story, and what gets blocked out by that sun is, you know, kind of mid-caps with a similar valuation story and, you know, compelling growth, but certainly the multiples are not there. And I think that, you know, in that lies a, you know, a great opportunity.
Josh, where are you and your team at Hennessy Advisors in Chapel Hill, North Carolina? I don't know why you didn't locate in Durham, Superior University down there. But anyway, what are you and your team doing in terms of work right now? What are the areas you're focusing on?
Sure. Yeah. So I would point, you know, in our Hennessy Cornerstone Midcap 30 Fund, where we're looking at valuation, earnings growth, and stock price momentum. And where that leads us is a lot of the consumer names that, you know, don't get the attention of, you know, maybe like a Costco or a Starbucks. You know, these are mid-cap names, companies like Mattel, Big Lots, and Meritage Homes. So, you know, strong free cash flow generating companies, you know, strong balance sheets. The multiples are interesting to me because I think these are, for the most part, well-known names, but, you know, Big Lots trading at 9 times forward earnings, Mattel at 16 times. Meritage at about 6 times forward earnings. So, you know, I think that, you know, value can be its own catalyst. And I don't think a lot of people agree with that, but I think that these names, they are strong names and they will live to see another day. And at some point, investors will inevitably turn their attention toward these overlooked type names.
What is the path forward for interest rates? Does it have to go higher from here? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I think about it a lot. So I've covered equities in some way, shape, or form for about 25 years, and I've never paid that much attention to the bond market as much as I do now. Mm-hmm. And first of all, you know, the bond market to me, you know, there might be some, obviously the Fed gets in the way of maybe true price discovery to a large degree, but the bond market's telling me that maybe we are borrowing some growth from future quarters now that we've reopened and there's this delayed wealth effect. So people are out spending money and, you know, you see that if you just walk down any street in this country probably. And so I think that we've been saying for so many years now that rates have to go higher, and every year that becomes less and less true. And so, yeah, I don't think they have to go higher. I think rates you know, versus overseas rates are somewhat elevated in the United States. And when I look at overseas markets and economies, they are not nearly in as good a shape as we are here in the United States for the most part. So I think that we have a lot to contend with overseas and in emerging markets. And I don't know how sustainable things could ever be if we don't get those economies reopened and functioning properly. So, you know, I'm not going to make any prediction on the 10-year or bonds in general, but, you know, I don't think rates have to go higher at all. And I think they could go a little bit lower.
All right, Josh, thank you so much. We appreciate that. As always, Josh Wine, he's a portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds, giving us his thoughts on the market here. He remains bullish here, but earnings coming in fast and furious will continue next week. We had the banks this week, as Josh mentioned, coming in pretty darn solid, but we're going to have some tech. We're going to have some consumer names next week. That will continue the narrative on earnings and this market. This is Bloomberg.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Looking at Moderna here, stock is up 9.8%, all-time high, $284. It's got, sporting a market cap of $114 billion, included today in the S&P 500. Of course, manufacturer of the Moderna vaccine, which has been so successful for so many patients for this COVID. Let's get a sense of what's going on at this company that's now, you know, probably started the, you know, 2 years ago, nobody really knew about it. Now it's a household name. John Murphy, he's a pharmaceutical analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence based in London. He joins us. John, tell us about this company. Give us a 30,000-foot overview of what this company really is. We know it as, you know, a manufacturer of a very effective vaccine, but give us a sense of what this company is about.
Sure, yeah, nice to join you. You summed it up very nicely. We hadn't really heard about this company, had we, a couple of years ago. Now, it has been around since 2010, but only came to market in 2018, and it was a bit of a minnow then, although at the time it created a splash because its IPO was $7.5 billion. So for a biotech, that was quite significant. So mRNA-based vaccine focus, looking at a number of different infectious diseases. You could argue they maybe got a little bit lucky or got a big leg up when COVID came along because clearly there was a lot of cash that came their way. But they have, for a number of years, been looking at areas such as flu, RSV, cytomegalovirus. So really looking to develop a broad pipeline of vaccines in the anti-infective space. And again, as I said, they clearly benefited from COVID here in terms of getting an acceleration in development. And I guess the question now is, after COVID, where do things go?
That is the question. What is the future for this company? We had a great conversation earlier this week talking about using that mRNA technology for cancer, for HIV. I mean, the hopes here are so high.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And you know what? Sometimes I think, and it's kind of natural, that when you see a new technology, expectations initially are high. They get a little bit disappointed, if you like, when these high expectations aren't met. And now we're kind of going up to that peak again. So I think if you look at the anti-infective areas, again, as I mentioned, the likes of flu, RSV, cytomegalovirus, these are probably more realistic in the next 3 to 5 years to see them come out with a product. I'm pretty long in the tooth, and I can tell you 20 years ago we were talking about cancer vaccines. We've not seen them come through. I wouldn't be betting my money on cancer delivering something there. HIV, again, looks like a pretty difficult area. But although maybe not as sexy, not as attractive, RSV, cytomegalovirus, these are $5 to $10 billion markets. So very, very large from that perspective.
All right, I'd love to talk to you about the economics of the vaccine. I'm looking at the FA function on the Bloomberg Terminal, which gives the income statement, balance sheet, all the good stuff you would need for financial analysis on mRNA, which is the Moderna symbol. $800 million in revenue in 2020. In 2021, analysts estimate $18.6 billion. Is all of that the vaccine? Talk to us about the economics for Moderna of this vaccine. They're not giving it away, are they?
It is all the vaccine. Yeah, that is essentially 100%. You're absolutely, that is the vaccine. And I think the big question as well, because as you said in your introduction, you got a stock here. It's $115 billion market cap. What is the sustainability of that income? So can we factor into our numbers what it's going to do? Is it going to do $20 billion again next year, for example, give or take? The company says it can do. And then what happens in the couple of years after that? In terms of the actual economics, they don't release or tell you exactly what they're charging, but you can estimate it's $20 to $30 a shot here, and of course they're going to have some associated costs, marketing costs. They've got the R&D costs, but it's going to be relatively profitable for them in the high income market, certainly. But like a lot of their competitors, this is being provided at cost to the low income markets, and COVAX, for example.
You know, John, I'm smart enough to know that I should not be going toe-to-toe with Mr. Paul Sweeney on level two income statement analysis for the CFA. What I can ask you, though, is take us away a little bit from fundamentals. And you have a stock that's now included in the S&P 500. What are you hearing from, we know, the portfolios that track the S&P that now have to buy the stock? How much of that is also included in a move that's now up 10% on the day?
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right, and I think that's exactly what it should be linked to, today's move. I think we've seen it before, because you get the fact that there's a number of index passive funds. You've also got mutual funds, for example, that index themselves against the S&P, and you guys would know better than me, but I understand there's in excess of $10 trillion that is indexed or benchmarked to the S&P. Now, not all of those have to go out and buy the stock today, but again, we've seen it before. You get a spike for the first couple of days, and then it normally settles down. Maybe with Moderna, because we've had this phenomenal run, maybe it doesn't settle down as quickly. But that's certainly what you do tend to see.
Hey, John, mRNA technology, that's now entered the lexicon for a lot of people as we've kind of dealt through this pandemic. Give us a sense of who the players are here besides Moderna. And, you know, is this something that we need to pay attention to going forward, this technology?
Yes, I think that's a really important question, a great point to bring up. And the reason for that is there was a lot of talk about this. There's a lot of buzzwords go around in pharmaceuticals, in science, and they talk about new technologies and what they're going to deliver. And a lot of times, there's a lot of talk, but they don't tend to deliver. Now, this is absolutely not the case here, but we've really got two leaders here. We've got Moderna on one side, and we've got BioNTech, the German company with whom Pfizer is partnered. They're the two leaders. They're a long way out. And it's interesting. There's a lot of others making moves or saying we want to get involved. Pfizer themselves have said they might start up their own area. Glaxo have mentioned it. Sanofi have mentioned it. But it takes a number of years to really get to understand the technology, make the appropriate investments. So at the moment, these guys are out on their own. How much of a lead? Maybe 4 to 5 years of a lead, something like that. But clearly, it's an area that is going to be super important going forward for vaccines.
Finally, just quickly here, I'm thinking, what does this mean for other sort of biotech companies that are also racing along with Moderna? And you sort of have these big pharmaceutical companies that are making big bets on some of these unprofitable companies at the time, but all they need is one big grand slam.
Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, the drug companies, the investors, all of us, right? If we're looking at things like that, if you can pick out that grand slam, absolutely. And that's why a lot of companies are paying huge amounts, and some cases people would say overpaying for new technologies.
Right.
It's not easy to be able to pick out, unfortunately. So I think this is great for the sector. Going in today, it gets people to focus on a sector that maybe they've not looked at before.
Hey, John, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate your insight and expertise. John Murphy, he's a pharmaceutical analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence based in London, giving us the latest on Moderna. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.